quickly, I'll just say a few words about the three commissioners. The chair is the Honorable Murray Sinclair, who was appointed Associate Chief Judge of the Provincial Court of Manitoba in March of 1988 and the Court of the Queen's Bench of Manitoba in January 2001. He was, in fact, Manitoba's first Aboriginal lawyer. He's well known for representation of Aboriginal people and his knowledge of Aboriginal legal issues. He's an adjunct professor of law and an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Graduate Studies of the University of Manitoba. And not surprisingly, he's won numerous awards, including a National Aboriginal Achievement Award most recently. The second member of the commission is Mary Wilson. She has more than 30 years of experience as an award-winning journalist, trainer, senior executive manager. She's been a university lecturer, a high school teacher in Africa, senior executive in Africa, a senior executive manager in both federal and territorial crown corporations, as well as an independent consultant on journalism. As a regional director for the CBC, she launched the first daily television news service for Northern Canada. She's also won numerous awards, and she was an associate board member of what would become the Aboriginal People's Television Network. Finally, I'd like to introduce to you Chief Wilton Littlechild, who in 1976 had the distinction of being the first Treaty First Nation person to acquire a law degree from the University of Alberta. Chief Littlechild is a respected lawyer and operates the law firm of J. Wilton Littlechild, barrister and solicitor, which is situated in the Emmenskin Reserve. He's a strong advocate for the rights of Indigenous peoples and a promoter of the implementation of treaties for the Indigenous peoples of Canada and the Crown. He's also played an extremely important role in the promotion of international recognition for Indigenous peoples' rights. And I'm proud to say he's one of our newest members to our advisory board. So again, we're very honored to have all three members here, and I'll turn the floor over to them. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bonjour, le Constituc, Rizan Agijic, Indigenous Cas, Rigo Dodem. Bonjour, Nimijian Nibas. I'm so grateful to see all of you here on this late afternoon weekday because, as a former student, I knew that every opportunity you could find to be able to stay away from classes or anything student like in an afternoon was something you look forward to. So I don't know if I'm your excuse for getting out of a class or whether we're really intriguing to you enough to get you here. We'll perhaps remain to be seen when you talk about what it is that you've heard. I want to thank the organizers for inviting us to be here. My name is Murray Sinclair. I'm the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and you heard a little bit about some of the experience that I've got in coming here. As the chair of the commission, task here is to introduce you to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada and to give you a little bit of information about it. Commissioner Wilson is going to talk to you about how we have gone about our work, and Commissioner Littlechild is going to talk to you about how our commission fits into the overall evolution of truth commissions, Truth and Reconciliation Commissions around the world based upon his experience with the United Nations. So I know that we have a tight timeline with you, particularly because it is late in the afternoon. So I want to begin to talk about that. But I always must begin by telling you a story. And the latest story is this. I always talk about my granddaughter, Sarah. Her name is Nimijian Nibas. And the other day when we were complaining about the weather for the 89th time of minus 30 degree weather in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and all of the frozen pipes that were going on around us, I said, I've never had the experience of having a winter so cold for so long. And she looked at me quizzically and she said, Mushum, when you were a little boy, did they have temperatures? So I always have to explain those things, that indeed we did have thermometers that measured temperature. But, of course, as soon as I explain something to me, then she goes to my wife and she says, Cookum, is that true? So my reputation for not being absolutely forthright with her is perhaps a reflection of what I need to do in order to build myself up in her eyes. but we do enjoy having her company when we visit. So let's talk a bit about what we're doing as a commission here in this country. Truth and Reconciliation Commissions generally are about transitional justice. Transitional justice is a process by which a state, a nation, moves from one period of governance to another period of governance in a way that allows for a peaceful transition into a new era. It allows for a change in the governance structure or a change in the relationship between a government and its citizenry. And transitional justice is what I would call reformative justice on an international scale or on a national scale. Just as transformative justice between two people is about healing justice. Transformative justice, as the courts have used it, is about identifying the problem and allowing two people to come to a resolution of that problem between themselves in order to be able to move on in a peaceful relationship or in a non-relationship, but still in a peaceful way. And so transformative justice at a personal level is one thing, but how do you achieve transformative justice at a national level? And so the idea of transitional justice evolved as a result of the experience of the Holocaust and the Second World War and the Nuremberg trials and the failure of the Nuremberg trials to be able to capture all of those who had committed crimes against humanity during the Second World War. And some other way of thinking about how a nation can move forward and come to terms with that past was part of the dialogue that led to Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. Everybody's aware of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions through the work of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which many of us have read about. Most of you were probably not old enough to have experienced what it was doing at the time, but nonetheless, it contributed to our knowledge and awareness and the lingo by which we talk about these things these days. But the South African Commission was not the first Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the world. The first one was in South America. And so since then, it has evolved, and it has taken on different roles and different parts, and it has become an approach to try to assist communities of people to come to terms with historical treatment or historical behaviors between those communities of people. So you have what we could call voluntary Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, such as in the United States, where black people and white people in the same community have had to come to terms with the racism of the past within their community, without there necessarily being a legislative basis for it. But most Truth and Reconciliation Commissions come about because they are mandated by law. They are created by government in order to address the wrongs of a past government, because the wrongs of the past government cannot be properly addressed through the prosecutorial system or through the civil justice system, and therefore those wrongs will continue to affect the behavior of people, the relationship between people, and the ability of the new government to be able to get on to govern the country unless the past is addressed. And so the South African Commission is a good example of that, where moving from the era of apartheid into a new era of a democratic regime, the government of South Africa saw the wisdom of creating a commission which would allow the population to address the atrocities of the apartheid era on both sides, and to allow perpetrators and victims and communities of people to come to terms with that past so the new government could get on with governing without constantly having the tension of a potential conflict that might lead to war, civil revolt, or violence, or additional violence between black and white people in their community. And so that was the ambition of that commission, and that is the ambition of most Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. But ours is a little bit different, and I'll tell you why. It's because residential schools were the era that we were asked to look at as a commission. Residential schools were created by the government following Confederation in 1867. And in 1867, when Confederation occurred, the Aboriginal people of the West, who were being brought into the fold through expansion of the Canadian Dominion into the Western provinces, were willing, I'm not sure eager is the right word, but certainly were willing to engage in dialogue with the new Dominion about how Aboriginal people could become partners with the new Dominion, could become equal participants in this new country that was being formed. And one of the vehicles that they saw, and it's very clear from the negotiations around the treaties, it's very clear from the speeches of the leaders at the time, that they wanted their children to be the ones that would help the people, the indigenous tribes of the West, to be able to move forward with this new government into a new era, because their children were the ones that were going to get the education to be able to assist the indigenous communities to become part of the new dominion. So they saw it as a means to participate as partners in Canada. And the example, or the evidence of that, is in fact in the treaties themselves. When the parties for the government of Canada came to the West to negotiate the treaties, they actually came with pre-printed and prepared documents to ask the Aboriginal people to give up their land, to sign their land over to the Crown, and to agree to move on to smaller pieces of land known as reserves. But the Indians had different ideas. They asked for schools to be constructed in their communities. So school clauses were included in the treaties, all of the treaties that were signed in Western Canada after Confederation. Treaty 1 and 2 had this clause, for example, where the government promised that they would build schools on each of the reserves that were being promised or committed to as part of the treaty-making process. And you'll see that whenever the Indians should desire it, the government would build a school for them, and they would fund the schools, they would pay for the teachers. So those promises are in all of the treaties of Western Canada. So that's just an example of how education was important. The government did not come to them and say, we want to have your kids educated and we want to build schools to put your kids in. The government, in fact, was required by the Indian negotiators to put this provision in the treaties. So the treaties were rewritten to put this and other clauses into the treaties that they wanted. But after the treaties were negotiated, the government messaging was this, that in fact, they were not going to hold to those promises to build the schools. The government messaging became, these were uncivilized people. These were inferior people. These were socially, culturally different people. And that they needed to be civilized became the common refrain. They needed to be civilized through a process involving Christianization. This example of this photograph of Thomas Moore was used as part of the propaganda to show that this was what the government intended. They would take this little Indian boy on the left side of the photo and they would turn him magically into this civilized boy on the right side of the picture. And this is a posed photograph, incidentally, and the evidence for that is, if you look carefully at the left-hand photograph, you'll see the little Indian boy has a six-gun in his hand. Not a lot of Indian boys were carrying around toy six-guns at the time, but that's what the photographer thought the image needed. Public Works Minister was responsible for building the new schools that the government wanted to establish to deal with these inferior people. And in 1883, Hector Langevin, the then Minister of Public Works, had this to say. In order to educate the children properly, we must separate them from their families. Some people may say that this is hard, but if we want to civilize them, we must do that. And the government, of course, knew that it was going to take several generations in order to effect the changes that they wanted. They knew they weren't going to do it overnight. But they set out determined exactly to go about doing that. They also knew that involving churches and missionary societies was a key to the success of the program of residential schools because missionary societies and Christian workers would work for free as part of their missionary zeal, as part of their commitment to their church, as part of their commitment to save souls. In 1920, we see a statement like this from then Deputy Superintendent General, or what we now call the Deputy Minister of Indian Affairs, Duncan Campbell Scott, says, I want to get rid of the Indian problem. Never said exactly what the Indian problem was, but I want to get rid of the Indian problem. I do not think, as a matter of fact, that the country ought to continuously protect a class of people who are able to stand alone. That statement in and of itself ignores the fact that Aboriginal people had in fact stood alone for at least 15, 20,000 years before the white man came here. So they didn't need protection, unless you thought they needed protection from the government of Canada, but it was not the government of Canada that was going to protect them from the government of Canada. He says, our objective is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada. that has not been absorbed into the body politic, and there is no Indian question and no Indian department. That is the whole object of this bill. You hear debate today about getting rid of the Indian Act, getting rid of the Department of Indian Affairs. Well, Duncan Campbell Scott came up with the idea right away. He knew that that was the way to go. But his way was a little more ruthless than the Aboriginal people of the day wanted it to be. And at the time that this was all going on, you may know your Canadian history, that Aboriginal people in the West were resisting Western expansion of the Dominion. Louis Riel, the Manitoba Resistance at Red River in 1870, the Saskatchewan Rebellion in 1885, all were indicators and markers that Aboriginal people were not going into this new relationship in the way that Canada wanted them to so willingly. And there's documentation that we have discovered in the archives which show, in fact, that military officials were encouraging the government of Canada to expand residential schools, to take children away from their parents, place them in these institutions under government care, because then it would allow them to be able to control Indian resistance to government expansion. If the kids are in the government's care, nobody's going to fight the government. And what do they call that today in military circles? They call that a human shield. Right? Everybody decries that. So the model of education, as you can see, that the government had chosen to follow was not the model of education that was wanted by the Indians, nor was it, in fact, the model that had been agreed upon in the treaties. They amended the Indian Act to make it mandatory for all parents to send their children to schools designated by the Superintendent General of Indian Affairs. And virtually from the outset, of course, the children and the parents were complaining about those schools, because right from the beginning, language and cultural traditions and practices were prohibited. Corporal punishment was administered freely. Children were demeaned from the very beginning of their attendance at the schools. They were told that they were savages, pagans, heathens, inferior, and dirty. And they were treated in accordance with those statements. They had their hair cut off, their clothing would be taken away from them, they'd be bathed in some kind of disinfectant, they'd be deloused. Siblings were separated from each other, brothers and sisters were prohibited from speaking to each other, boys and girls were prohibited from speaking to each other. And of course, the way in which the children were treated and the schools were imposed on the part of the Aboriginal community was received with some mixed feelings, because some parents wanted those treaty promises to be upheld, and there's correspondence on the file to government from the 19th century showing they're demanding their treaty promises be fulfilled. But others recognized that the schools, the education system that they were going to get was only what the government was prepared to get them, and if their kids were going to be educated, then they had to take what the government was offering. But in the schools, of course, the children experienced institutionalization, intolerance. They were separated from their family, from their community for long periods of time. They received demeaning treatment. They were physically punished. And even if they weren't physically hurt as victims of violence in the schools, and we'll talk in a minute about the prevalence of that, they nonetheless lived in a constant state of fear and oppression that this might happen to them. Language was denied, as was promised. Access to family was denied. Awareness of family. When you're raised in an institution, you're not raised in a family environment. And the basic rules of how to behave in a family, how to treat each other in a family, how to raise children, how to be raised as a child, how to relate to a mother, how to relate to a father, how to relate to your siblings, are all damaged by being raised in an institution from the time you're a little child until you're an adult. Culture was denied. Culture, of course, is very important to everybody. We all have our own sense of culture. We all have our own sense of who we are. Culture gives us pride, gives us ambition each day to behave in accordance with the model of behavior that those other people of our culture show us, because we want to be like them. We have our heroes from our culture, but all of this was denied to them. And European religious belief systems were imposed. Within the schools, we know that children died in large numbers. Some of the schools reported 24 to 42% of children died every year. Just think about that. If you operated a system in this country today, or at any point in time, in which 24, one out of every five children, or two out of every five children died every year in your school, there would be criminal investigations around that. Dr. Peter Bryce, who was the chief medical officer for the Department of Indian Affairs at the time, responsible for Indian residential school students, did a report, and he referred to it as a national crime. And he was subsequently kicked out of office by Duncan Campbell Scott, the one whose quotes I gave you earlier. Within the schools, we now know that abuse, physical abuse and injuries occurred. Children were sexually abused, became a haven for sexual predators. Bullying occurred so that abuse between students started to occur. Emotional violence was prevalent within the schools. And not only that, but the children themselves did not receive an adequate education within the school system. There were no requirements for there to be any educational standards for the most of the time the schools were in place. There was no curricula that the schools were required to follow. Those who taught in the schools were not required to be certified as teachers or to go for teacher training, and many of them, in fact, were missionary people, nuns, priests, people who had committed their life to the church, and that their responsibility was to teach the traditions of the church, the beliefs of the church, to the children. And, of course, a great deal about the schools themselves was hidden from all of Canada. In your education, no matter what age you are, you never received anything in your school telling you about residential schools beyond, perhaps, in the last little while, the fact of their existence. But so much about what went on in schools, in fact, became known throughout the Aboriginal community and became common knowledge. Well over 150,000 students were sent to these schools that are listed in the agreement that we have been mandated by. And, of course, their reality bore little resemblance to values of higher or even basic education that was promised. They learned few marketable skills. They lost all of their traditional knowledge, virtually all of their traditional knowledge. The longer they were in the school, the less likely they were to be able to keep any part of their language, any part of their culture, and therefore any strength in their relationship with their family. Schools were badly understaffed throughout their existence. They were underfunded virtually from the beginning and continued that way throughout. And teachers were underqualified. Food shortages within the schools were rampant, and it left the children in an undernourished state, weakened and susceptible to diseases such as tuberculosis. And the school environments themselves, the sanitary conditions within the schools, contributed to their deaths, as Dr. Bryce and his report found. Neglect within the schools was common, violence was common, punishments were frequent and were quite severe. Children ran away in large numbers, escape was common. Unknown numbers of children died from exposure as a result of running away from the schools. Children died for other reasons that we're still trying to determine. And almost all of the children who died in the schools were buried in graves that didn't have markers, or if they had markers, the markers have quickly vanished and no longer allow us to find out where they're buried. And claims of physical and sexual abuse within residential schools have characterized 90% of individual court actions that have been filed against the churches and the government, and almost all of the criminal prosecutions that have occurred have stemmed from sexual abuse allegations. And one of the questions we always put forward to members of the public, such as you, is imagine what you would do if, in fact, this was your child. If this was your niece, your nephew, your grandchild, what would you do about this? Well, you'd resist it. In other words, you'd do your damnedest to keep the kids from being taken away to put in school. You'd protest against it. You'd go out and you'd march up and down the streets with your placards. You'd go to Ottawa, lobby the government. You'd go public to the media. You'd protest. You'd challenge it in court. Hire a lawyer. Common thing today, right? Hire a lawyer. Go to court. Get the court to make a ruling. You'd challenge it through the political process. So you'd vote those people out of office who were doing these things to you. Or you might go to war. Now, going to war was out of the question because they had your kids. Remember what I said earlier? They deliberately held on to kids to keep people from going to war. So that wasn't much of an option. So the government handled all of that by changing the laws to make all of those things impossible. So legal punishments were imposed on parents who failed to comply with a direction to send their children to the schools. Every year, we heard about regular roundups that were held in the communities, where literally Indian agents, police officers, government officials, sometimes the military, just arrived in the community, rounded up all the kids without preparing them for the trip and just taking them away to schools. Often, in fact, children who were not even eligible because of age to go to school were taken away and placed there. Government paid what must have been enormous costs at the time for those transportation trips, but they were not prepared to pay for them to be returned. Some parents did successfully hide their children. We've heard some of those stories. Not only was the government concerned about the children, however, they also wanted to go one step further, and this is what I say. They not only wanted to take the children away from the village. Remember, it takes a village to raise a child, a common refrain. We're all aware of what that means. But it's not just the parents that are responsible for the education of a child, but the whole community has a role to play in the education of children. The government not only wanted to take the children away from their village, but then they set out to destroy the villages, literally. They placed legal restrictions on cultural gatherings. So the Sundance and Potlatch laws, which were a whole host of legislation that were put in place to prohibit large gatherings of Indian people from coming together, because at those gatherings, they were a threat to government. They were a threat to increased protest, increased anger about what the government was doing. So those gatherings were outlawed. Indians could be prosecuted for wearing Indian garb. 1885 amendment to the Indian Act. Indians could not dress up like Indians. Other people could dress up like Indians, but Indians could not dress up like Indians. Movement was restricted. The pass system was created so that in order to leave your community as an Indian person, you had to get a pass from the Indian agent before you could leave, and that limited your access to your child at the school. So if you wanted to go to the school and get your kid out, you weren't given a pass. You could be arrested, be detained by the police, and kept in custody. But it also prohibited people from moving from community to community to foment resistance. The right to go to court was restricted. Any Indian who wanted to sue the government of Canada for anything under the Indian Act had to get permission from the Minister of Indian Affairs first. That was an amendment to the Act in 1888. Nobody ever got permission that we know of. And if lawyers wanted to give legal opinion, or if an Indian wanted to go to a lawyer to get a legal opinion about their rights, a lawyer could be disbarred simply for agreeing to give a legal opinion. That was another amendment to the Indian Act. So you see, the right to resist, the right to protest, the right to go to court was taken away from Indian people. And even those who were friends of the Indians were prohibited from accessing court. They also had to get permission. We all know about the Diefenbaker Amendment in the early 1960s. It gave the Indians the right to vote. My grandfather, to his dying day, voted conservative because he believed, and you'll love that, Joe, incidentally. He voted progressive conservative, exactly right, because he believed that Diefenbaker gave him the right to vote. But Indians had the right to vote back in the 1800s. They had the right to vote until the 1891 amendment to the Indian Act, called, interestingly, the Indian Advancement Act of 1891, which said that Indians could only vote if they gave up their right to be an Indian. So they had to give up their status, they had to move off the reserve, they had to give up their treaty rights, and on top of that, they had to qualify under regular voting laws. They had to own property worth a value of $100. And you had to be a man. You had to be over 21. So women totally lost their right to vote. And even under the Indian Act, they changed the form of government so that traditional forms of government were eliminated, and only Indian band councils elected under the Act were permitted. Only men could run for office. Only men could vote for those men running for office. Women within the indigenous community had their power totally stripped away by amendments to the Indian Act. And, of course, the power of those councils to do anything was restricted. And so within a short period of time, not within one or two generations, if this only had occurred for one or two generations, for 10, 20 years, it wouldn't have really been a real serious problem. It would have been damaged, but people would have been able to overcome it. But it was in place for seven generations, for 130 years. So we see loss of identity, loss of language, loss of culture, loss of pride, loss of self-respect, loss of respect for education, and loss of respect for government, and loss of respect for this nation, for the country itself, because of the way that people were being treated by their own government, by the government that had signed these treaties with them. That was a very prominent part of the relationship. Families themselves were lost through disruption. A lot of children, even if they were allowed to go back home after their schools were finished with them, often did not because they couldn't speak the language of their parents. They couldn't relate to the people back home. So they went elsewhere. And some of the schools, in fact, arranged marriages between children so that the Christianized child in the school could not go back home and marry a pagan, had to marry another Christian before they left the school. And of course, leadership skills that those people in the schools would have had, which the people who signed the treaties on behalf of the Indians wanted them to bring back to their communities, those leaders were lost to the communities because they didn't go back or they couldn't relate back to their communities. Tribes lost their status. They lost their power to do things, lost their authority to sovereign, to self-govern. The Canadians themselves lost the benefit of understanding and having a proper relationship with Canada's indigenous population. So this was not just a problem for the Aboriginal people who were victimized by this, but it was also a problem for the whole nation, because the nation was losing out. And Canada, of course, lost the respect of Indian people generally. And, of course, the reputation of Canada in the international community, as more and more of this became known over the many generations, also became diminished. And the children and the grandchildren of those who were taken away to these schools also suffered as a result. And I don't have time to go into all of that, but there's a lot of impact on intergenerational populations. There were healthy teachers within this very unhealthy environment, and many students, in fact, have come forward at our hearings and talked to us about the good teachers who tried to protect them, tried to take care of them, the good relationships they had with some teachers. They didn't want everyone to think that everybody treated them exactly the same. But it was the system which even those good teachers were unable to function in properly. And in terms of the communities, the economic impact on the community was that lifestyles changed, the ability of individuals to take advantage of their naturally passed along training from their parents to live off the land or live in accordance with the teachings of the land was lost to them. Economic authority, decision-making was undermined. Economic relations generally were negatively affected by the Indian Act. And after a while, we begin to see things changing. And things take a while to change, but they have changed in the last 30 or 40 years. We begin to see lawsuits. Individuals who had been abused in the schools, who had suffered injuries in the schools, began finding the strength and finding lawyers who were prepared to represent them and take legal actions. Churches began to become aware of the complaints that survivors were making about how the churches treated them or how the church's employees treated them. Churches began to apologize. 35,000 lawsuits were commenced over a relatively short period of time in Canadian courts throughout the country, and they became amalgamated into seven class actions in seven different jurisdictions, and eventually were all merged into one large class action in the province of Ontario. And in a decision called Blackwater versus Plint, the Supreme Court of Canada finally said the federal government and the churches are legally liable for the injuries sustained by students in the schools at the hands of those employed by the government and the churches. And it divided liability on a 75-25 basis. So 75% liability goes to the government, 25% liability goes to the church that runs the school. So that broke open the whole question of resolution of all those lawsuits, resulting eventually in the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement in 2006. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was created by that settlement agreement. And in 2008, you see parliamentary apologies. Prime Minister of Canada Stephen Harper in 2008 stood up in Parliament and apologized to all of those who were affected by residential schools. But the settlement agreement only includes 140 schools. The Aboriginal children went to far more schools than that. But the Government of Canada, which pays 75% of the freight when it comes to the liability payment, only recognizes liability for 140 schools that they say they managed, because it's liability for employees, don't forget. It's not liability for establishing a bad system. It's liability for the employees. And the Government of Canada says if those were not our employees, we're not responsible. There are over 1,400 other schools that Aboriginal people were sent to over the course of this same period of time that are not listed in the settlement agreement. But the settlement agreement and the apology that followed clearly recognized that the school system itself was a wrong-headed policy. Our commission, created by the settlement agreement, commenced work in 2008. The first set of commissioners resigned virtually right away. We were appointed to this task in 2009. Under the settlement agreement, our commission was given 5 years to do its work and a budget of $60 million. Our responsibilities are to do a number of tasks, and these are just some of them, but the main ones. We're to go out and gather statements from the survivors and those who worked in the schools to see if we can, utilizing those statements, determine what went on in the schools on a day-to-day basis. We are responsible for receiving and archiving all of the relevant documents that are being held by the churches, by the government, and placing those documents into an archive available for future research. We're responsible for conducting activities to educate the public about residential schools. We are responsible for community events that allow the communities where the survivors are living to be able to conduct activities that will contribute to the healing of the community, the healing of the survivors. We are called upon to hold 7 national events. Our 7th and last national event will be at the end of March in Edmonton. And Joe Clark, is one of our honorary witnesses who participates with us in that. And I suspect he'll talk a little bit about that when he gets a chance to speak. We are required to write a report, and that report is to provide a full and complete history of residential schools in this country, including the legacy of the schools. And we are to engage the parties in a dialogue about reconciliation. But we have certain challenges to reconciliation that may not be apparent on the face of it. Remember what I said about transitional justice? Usually it's about moving from one regime to the next regime. Well, in this case, the regime didn't change. The wrongdoers, that is the Government of Canada, and the thinking behind its policies are still largely in place. And so convincing the Government of Canada, and to a certain extent the churches, that their background policies, which led to their participation and development of this system, is still a difficult part of the reconciliation process. Changing the way they behave is a real challenge. There is a thought going on amongst the parties that the ones who need to reconcile are the Aboriginal people, that they need to adapt to the new reality. The Crown is sovereign. The government will do what it wants. We'll stop doing residential schools. We'll stop abusing the kids. But now, let's move on. And there's more to it than that. The Aboriginal organizations that speak for the survivors, of course, are dependent on government funding, and we've heard lately about government cutbacks in funding Aboriginal organizations that have contributed to their feeling that they're being undermined. And Canadians themselves have difficulty understanding that this is not an Aboriginal problem, that this is, in fact, a Canadian problem. It belongs to all of us. Because While Aboriginal children were being taught this way, and being taught that they were inferior, their cultures were inferior, their language was inferior, their people were inferior, that their history was irrelevant, that they were pagans, uncivilized, heathens, that very same message was being given in the public schools. And the Aboriginal children who went to those public schools were receiving that message. And what that means, of course, is that all Aboriginal children being educated in whichever school system they went to were being mistreated educationally about who they were. And we see that in the continued high dropout rates that Aboriginal children show us in their behavior. When they can get out of that system, they do. Aboriginal graduation rates in the public schools are still very low, much lower than for non-Aboriginal children. And, of course, being taught that Aboriginal people were inferior has a flip side to it, and that is that Canadians of European ancestry are superior. And so it creates an aura of superiority, an aura that we have come from a better background than you come from. And that harms the relationship, eventually, between students in the same school system. And those of you who've been educated in the public schools of this country with Aboriginal children in the classroom or in the school with you may know a little bit about what I'm talking about. So that's why we say all Canadians have to take ownership of this legacy, and we all have to take ownership of the history. We all have to take a look carefully at our own biases and where they come from, and we also have to be prepared to question their legitimacy. And I think we all have to recognize that the way that Canada, not just the government, but the way that institutions within Canada are doing business is going to have to change because it reflects part of that educational history. So reconciliation for us is about changing this history of oppression and negativity and allowing Canadians to relate to each other in a more positive and healthy way. It requires a restoration of a process by which, as well, self-respect can be restored to Aboriginal people. And sometimes you'll hear people talk about decolonization. That's a common refrain I hear, particularly from academic people. And I kind of wonder what they're talking about, decolonization. It's almost like you take something off and you leave it aside. Well, to me, decolonization is really about a process by which Aboriginal people in particular can find a way to gain their self-respect, to gain pride in who they are. And if that's what they mean by decolonization, then I'm all for it, because I think that's an important part. And I actually think before we can have mutual respect between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, we probably need to ensure that Aboriginal people have a sense of self-respect, that they have their pride and have a good sense of pride in who they are, and that they know what that means. They know who they are. They know where they come from. They know what their cultures are all about in order that they can properly withstand the looks and the snickers and the sneers that sometimes are given to them across the table or across the room. And, of course, on both sides, it requires a commitment. Reconciliation requires a commitment that in Canada, at least, forming relationships that engender mutual respect is a commitment we'll hold to for the long term. So reconciliation to us is about respect. But the one thing we tell people is we need to remember it took us 7 generations, 150 years almost, of residential schools to create this damaged relationship, to create this damage within Aboriginal people, within Aboriginal communities. It's going to take us a long time to fix it. It's going to take us a significant period of time to fix it. And we need to be committed to fixing it, though. And it is about having a vision for reconciliation, a commitment to mutual respect, and measuring everything that we do today and going forward against the question of, will it move us into a position of mutual respect, or will it allow us to maintain a relationship of mutual respect? So, those are my comments to you. I'm going to hand it over now to Commissioner Wilson and have her talk to you a bit about what she's going to talk about. And I think Are you going to find me?